From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is KCRW's first time ever awards special. I'm Kim Masters, host of The Business, here with Elvis Mitchell, host of The Treatment. Hi, Elvis.
Hello, Kim.
So each week on our shows, we deal with different aspects of show business.
Yes, Kim. Yes, we do.
I deal with the business of the business, hence the name of the show, The Business, the people and the stories behind the making of movies and TV shows. And you, Elvis, on The Treatment?
On The Treatment, I give them what they call a delightful philosophical shiatsu, the treatment, if you will, and they talk about what guides them, the obsessions that make them want to make these projects in the first place.
So tonight, the two shows come together. We're going to be looking at this monstrosity called awards season. It's been going on for months now. We're like crawling to the finish line.
It's longer than the NBA playoffs.
Longer than the NBA playoffs. And this weekend, it wraps up with these two big shows, which are very different.
Well, provisionally very different. Certainly that line between them gets smaller and smaller all the time. As we saw last year, between the Oscars and the Spirits, they all had five of the same Best Actress nominees came from the independent spirit world. What that shows is really that that system is the way that Hollywood goes to sort of make the films that they don't want to spend money on anymore.
Well, let me just set the agenda. The Independent Spirit Awards ceremony takes place Saturday afternoon under a tent in a parking lot on the beach. And the Oscars, a little more stuffy affair, slightly more stuffy, in what used to be called the Kodak Theater. I think Kodak has got many problems of their own. It may not be called that for long.
I think it's the Subway or the Tostitos Theater.
Yeah,
now.
It may be something like that. It's on Hollywood Boulevard, where traffic will be gridlocked and terrible. And some films are in contention at both events. But really, as you say, the smaller films are at the Independent Spirit Awards, and sometimes they sneak into the Oscars because the big studios, I would have to say, probably aren't making so many awards-worthy films.
No, viz. The Descendants and The Artist, which are both big nominees at the Spirit Awards and the Oscars. The Spirit Awards ceremony, for me, I've always said it's like a high school assembly, and all the cool kids go outside and smoke. And they run back in when they hear their award, and they run
right
back out and finish smoking. It's kind of like the indie version of the MTV Awards, where people kind of care during the moment, and then they get in the car and they leave the awards behind so they can go and basically sort of press their clothes for the Oscars the very next day.
Right. It's a much more spontaneous event and rowdy than the Oscars ever will be. The criteria, you might not be surprised to hear, for these two awards are quite different.
There's a budget limit for the Spirit Awards. It's $20 million or less. And there's also a category in the Spirit Awards, the Cassavetes Award, and that award goes to films that were made for less than $500,000.
So the Oscars, again, the system for selecting the winners and the nominees is very different. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has various divisions, but generally speaking, I think most of the big categories are voted on by the membership. You know, these are several thousand, I think 6,000 something.
6,500, yeah.
Yeah. The Independent Spirit Awards, a different group.
Yes, well, the nominees are chosen by a blue ribbon panel, if you will, a PBR of people, experts, cinematographers, actors, directors, casting directors, film critics. I've been on the nominating committee a few times myself, and I can say this now. I'm now an employee of Film Independent through the series at LACMA, the film series, but I no longer get to be a member of the nominating committee for the Spirit Awards.
Because you're a person on the staff?
I'm a person on the staff. That's right. Okay. We want to avoid conflict of interest in any way, or in my case, people being interested in me in any way.
Right.
We want to avoid
that at all costs.
And what feels like, you know, basically 3 days of EST, a weekend where we look at all the films, or people have seen all the films throughout the year, and we go and select the nominees, and then the membership of Film Independent is allowed to vote on the Spirit Awards. After that, the entire membership, I'm not sure what the numbers are, but if you pay the membership fee to be part of it, it's not nearly as self-selecting as the Oscars, which turned away poor Rodney Dangerfield three times.
Right.
He could have been a member of Film
Independent. He could have, but he got no respect.
That's a public radio joke, ladies and gentlemen.
Sorry.
If you're just joining us, I'll tell you what you're listening to. I'm Elvis Mitchell, host of The Treatment. I'm here with Kim Masters. She hosts The Business on KCRW. We're talking about the big award season coming to its spectacular conclusion this weekend. The Independent Spirit Awards, Saturday. The Oscars, Sunday. Who are you betting on? Or are you watching the Fox Network instead?
So both of us have been fortunate enough to have some of the major nominees from some great films and films that were even nominated.
You were ahead of the curve, Kim. You were there before these nominees came out. You had these people on your show.
And you did too.
Well, I guess that's true. But I'm calling you.
But we've brought along some clips from some of those interviews. First, we're going to talk a little bit about what the awards mean. So how important is an Independent Spirit Award to someone in the independent film community?
Well, it's probably the kind of thing you talk about on your show. It certainly becomes a way to position the film for an Oscar campaign. I mean, you look at certainly people, you look at Milk, which got nominations, but then you also look at the Wrestler, which won for Best Actor, but Mickey Rourke didn't win that award. But last year, or recently rather, you look at Natalie Portman and the run-up that Black Swan made, and that was sort of key, or Jeff Bridges getting the win at the Spirit Awards, and that was key. It becomes another way of sort of setting these things up as potential Oscar winners. But the thing that I think that really separates finally the Spirit Awards from the Oscars is that people are just so thrilled. They really are thrilled to be there. And it's a hard cliche that I can feel myself wincing and the polyester in my socks kind of curling up as I say it. But it is true. People are so happy to be there. I remember the year that Derek Luke won for Antoine Fisher. And he said 2 years before he had been a waiter serving at the Spirit Awards.
Wow.
He was one of the caterers there. And that would never happen at the Oscars. The idea of somebody winning saying, you know, last year I was walking Mickey Rourke on stage, and now I'm a winner. I mean, there is this kind of thing that it feels like there's no caste system at the Spirit Awards, that anybody can win, and people can speak forever. And for good or ill, there's that sort of lighted powder keg effect of the Spirit Awards that the Oscars just don't have.
The Oscars, I think, are sort of, you know, the best report card that you can get in the industry. I mean, it's all very well and good to have a huge blockbuster or a franchise and be that guy who has the Bond series for the moment or whatever. But when it really comes to prestige, you know, you want the Oscar. And everybody seems to want, there's almost no one except maybe like Woody Allen who doesn't, when it comes to it, campaign for the Oscar. I mean, even Helen Mirren or, you know, George Clooney we see this year, he really wants the Oscar, you can tell.
He's kind of inescapable at this point. I thought he was going to turn for one of the Republican debates campaigning for the
perhaps. Senate. Well, if there were Democratic debates, maybe it would have been different. But the fact is, you know, I think he maybe thought Brad Pitt, he obviously is very much, they're very much aware of each other, Brad Pitt and Moneyball, George Clooney and The Descendants. And I think that, you know, they're in it to win it, as they say on American Idol. And you know, you could, in terms of money, the bounce for a performance or for a Best Picture award can be something, especially for one of the smaller films that we've been talking about at the Independent Spirit Awards. But sometimes, you know, there just is a ceiling and people are not going to those movies. Even when they win Best Picture, they just don't go that far.
This is this thing, I was just talking about this with somebody recently, that's happened, I think, in the last 15 years or so, that there's been this shift from like big studio, kind of middle-brow melodramas that used to get nominated all the time. To some extent, that ground has been ceded to the indies.
Absolutely.
You know, studios aren't interested in that kind of thing anymore. And I think it's one of the reasons that Meryl Streep, to me, feels kind of like a hometown favorite, because she's the woman who straddles both those worlds. I mean, a studio will finance a movie with Meryl Streep in it, but she also does indie projects as well because she wants to act. And I feel like that's the thing that's keeping her alive to some extent. I guess in a way, Clooney is kind of that guy too.
Very
somebody
much
goes
so,
back
yeah.
and forth between those two worlds. In fact, realistically, he's probably more welcome in the indie world than the studio world these days.
But there is, as I said, like with a movie like Hurt Locker, it wins, and yet there just aren't that many people that are going to the theater. There's a bounce, but it's not dramatic. And I think, you know, I'm just leading into the first films we're going to talk about today, because it is nominated for both Spirit Awards and Oscars, and that's The Artist. That is a film that has a very small gross, really. It didn't cost a lot, but it's not, despite all the promotion, the gross is not that big. And I think the smart money says even if it wins, there's just a finite number of people out there in the heartland who want to go see a movie that's almost entirely silent, in black and white, and commercially the Oscar will help it, but not as much as you might have thought a few years
see,
ago.
See, as you talk about this, I find myself wondering about this and have been for years, what the Oscars really do anymore. Especially with the death knell of home video. 5 years ago, where if you won an Oscar and the movie's no longer released, you get a big burst of DVD sales.
Right.
People aren't buying DVDs anymore.
No, they might rent it, stream it.
Yeah, I mean, they'll watch it on their iPad on the way to the plane before they have to turn it off and turn off their Kindle, and then they'll basically watch Moneyball as it's being projected on the plane. But I've really been thinking about this a lot because I feel like in the way that the Independent Spirit Awards probably mean more just because, you know, you're not doing it for the prestige. You're doing it because you fought with every iota of your being and literally every cent you had in the bank to get the movie made. The real satisfaction is in people seeing it. And what the Spirit nominations do, and this is a conversation I had many times in that room, is I fought for movies to get nominated because I just thought they deserved the attention. And I've run into so many filmmakers over the years who go, oh, my God, it was so great to be nominated because now I have a career. And I don't know if the Oscars even do that anymore.
So what you just talked about, Elvis, is exactly what we talked about on The Business with the director and producer of The Artist. Thomas Langman, the producer of the film, came on the show with Michelle Hazanavicius, who is the director. And Thomas Langman talked, you know, about that moment when he truly had to roll the dice in a very personal way. He put his money where his mouth was.
I went to see the partner that I work with, and well, most of them said no, but we finally found pieces of what we needed, and I must admit I had to put the rest of it.
You had to put the rest of it?
Yes.
Which is not the usual thing.
No, it doesn't exist usually.
Not too often, yeah.
Not too often, yeah. But that's the way cinema has been done for many, many years. Producers were taking risk. Now it's true that the system is a bit different. But I'm a bit unconscious. it's true that my mother used to say that my biggest strength was to be unconscious.
Just oblivious to the danger, you mean?
Yeah. For me, cinema and producing is about taking a risk. It's about doing bets.
Well, you're taking a risk right now. We're talking about the awards. I'm Elvis Mitchell, host of The Treatment. I'm here with Kira Masters, the host of The Business. We talk about these things on our shows all the time, about these fights that these people basically wager with themselves and the business, Big B, in addition to your show, to get these movies made. The other thing that's been happening, too, over the last few years, there's been this kind of interesting battle for supremacy in the Oscars prestige world between two small studios, the Weinstein Company and Fox Searchlight. And Searchlight, I think it really supplanted the Weinsteins over the last few years. They've got really good at doing this, and they shouldn't be underestimated. And they've turned The Descendants into a real contender, a movie that the director, Alexander Payne, came on after it was kind of already in motion. He was producing it and stepped in to direct. And now it's got this – I hate to use the word you hear on the political talk, but this enormous momentum behind it in terms of certainly best actor for George Clooney.
Sup, bro?
Don't ever do that to me again. Get ready. We're going to go see your grandparents. And Scotty, Auntie Esther's going to come watch you.
Dad, Sid's coming with us, okay?
Yeah, listen, Sid, what's going on this week is really a family matter. You understand? Sid's not going to be interested in meeting your grandparents. He's going to be bored stiff.
Dad, I told you that he was going to be with me. I'll be a lot more civil with him around.
I would agree on the Best Acting Award. I would say The Descent, you know, Fox Searchlight, they've had some winners. They had Slumdog Millionaire in recent years, Little Miss Sunshine, Crazy Heart, which won for Jeff Bridges. You know, these, they are good at it. They're making money on these, in some cases, lots of money.
They're really in it to make
Black
a business
Swan,
of it.
For
yes,
God's sake.
Absolutely.
They didn't finance it, but they distributed it and released it.
The Wrestler as well. I mean, you think about the Oscars of the last 10 years, Searchlight has had a presence in basically every one of these Oscar ceremonies. And in those years where people thought that Harvey Weinstein and his brother were on the ropes and basically out of the business, Searchlight kind of stepped in, and given the paucity of all the other contenders, it's shown itself to be a place you go now. And in fact, the three companies probably that dominate the Oscars are Weinstein, Searchlight, and for the foreign films, Sony Picture Classics.
Now, Sony does have Sony Pictures Classics, and they also, I think, you know, Elvis, you and I would agree, have a studio chief in the main studio, Amy Pascal, who is really maybe the last studio chairman in Hollywood who cares about movies as something other than money machines, with a really passionate attachment.
And also a lover of filmmakers as well.
Absolutely. Very attached to certain filmmakers. And she fought for another movie that we are going to talk about, which is Moneyball, nominated for the Oscar for the Best Picture. It and for Brad Pitt, of course, as well.
You get on base, we win. You don't, we lose. And I hate losing, Chubby. I hate it. I hate losing more than I even want to win. And there's a difference.
No bunts.
Bunts is not.
Not even third baseman's back.
No bunting whatsoever.
If someone bunts on us, just pick it up and throw it first. Don't try to be a hero and go to second. Let them make the mistakes.
Patient.
And when your enemy's making mistakes, don't interrupt them. They're giving you an out, man. They're just giving it to you. Take it. Say thank you. Another thing, no more stealing.
That's what I do. That's what you pay me to do.
No, I pay you to get on first, and I get thrown out in second. This is a process. It's a process. It's a process.
That movie was on the brink of falling apart. Steve Soderbergh had come in. Brad Pitt was attached. Soderbergh had written an approach to this thing. And at the 11th hour, the entire thing fell apart. They replaced the director and started from scratch. The producer, they brought in Scott Rudin and Aaron Sorkin, who had done so well with Social Network. They brought in Bennett Miller. He hadn't made a movie in years.
And made only one movie before that, the feature Capote, which is, again, getting back to my point about the indie world being the AAA team for the studios. They pick and choose. It's funny, one guy who started in the indie world, Steven Soderbergh, being replaced by another guy who basically is just out of the indie world, Bennett Miller.
We on The Business had Bennett Miller, the director, on the show, and he talked about, you know, making the decision to plunge in the middle of a very troubled situation.
I got a phone call asking, do I like baseball? I said, I used to when I was a kid, but I hadn't followed it in years.
Is this a Sony call or a DeLuca call or a
Brian Rachel? Lord.
Oh, Brian Lord at CAA. Okay.
Yeah.
Brad's agent, we should say. Mm-hmm.
Who said, you know, this thing had just happened, that the project had fallen apart and that they were going to be looking for somebody. And so I read the thing that Sorkin had worked on, and then I read the thing that Zalian had delivered. Then I read the book, and you know, Brian had said to me, if you could see your way through to a vision of this thing, Brad would want to talk. From my perspective, there nothing existed that represented the kind of film that I thought I would want to make. But regardless, got on an airplane and sat with Brad, who I believe was the one who, or at least that's what he tells me, that he says that I was his idea.
And that was Bennett Miller, the director of Moneyball. I'm Elvis Mitchell, host of The Treatment, the radio show on KCRW. I'm also sitting here with Kim Masters. She's the host of The Business. We're talking about the movies you know and love and you should know and love as we move closer and closer to the independent spirits and the Oscars. And a movie that is a Spirit Award nominee that people thought might be an Oscar nominee is the movie Drive, which I think one of the things that maybe works against Drive in terms of being an Oscar nominee is it doesn't have a really particularly satisfying end. I mean, it feels like a movie built around a movie star than a satisfying motion picture. And I don't know if I've ever seen a movie that seems to genuflect in the glow of its star's pecs as much as Drive does. It's really a love letter.
At least not an independent movie.
No, it probably happens more in independent films than studio films, but it's a movie that happened for Nicholas Winding Refn because he had several things fall apart, and he came on my show to talk about this kind of serendipitous path that led him to making Drive with the star he loves so much, Ryan Gosling.
Well, it was what I call a telekinetic relationship. We literally were able to read each other's minds. It started out by having a very strange meeting between us, you know. Actually, I was in L.A. to do a movie with Harrison Ford. It's called Dying of the Light. It was going to be a CIA agent whose life, you know, is running out. He goes on an existentialistic journey and dies at the end. So Paul Schrader's script, beautiful. Killing Harrison Ford was like, oh my God, can I kill Harrison Ford in a movie? I've achieved something. So here I was in Hollywood working on it, working with Harrison, and Harrison decided not to die. Okay, out goes the movie. as you're trying to salvage it, Ryan Gosling calls me, and I've never met him. And he asked if I would meet with him and, you know, talk about maybe doing something together. I switch gear, go meet Ryan. The only problem is that I have a high fever, so I'm basically quite ill. Harrison gets me anti-flu drugs, which gets the fever down, but also makes me high as a kite, like really stoned out of my mind, because I'm not used to taking drugs anymore. I was such in an emotional turmoil at that meeting that, you know, that I was like an open aura of things going in and out of my head and out of my head. I can't communicate with the guy because I can't talk, really. And he had sent over a script the day before that was a Universal project he was interested in called Drive. It was based on James Hallis's book. And so when we met and I couldn't really have a conversation, he drove me back home to the hotel to lie down because I was so out of it. And that's when, you know, he turns on the radio. It's R.S. Speedwagons. Can't fight this feeling anymore. So, you know, when you're really stoned, you do stupid stuff. I turn it up really loud, and I start singing to the song in the car, which is very rude to do with other people in it. And I start to cry because I'm getting some kind of emotional turmoil. I'm just completely out of it. I miss my wife. I miss my kids. What will I do for them? What am I doing in Los Angeles? And that's when I get this idea, oh, my God, we're going to do a movie about a man who drives around in a car at night listening to pop music, because that is his emotional relief. And that is what I experienced at that exact moment.
It's funny because there was so much Oscar buzz specifically for the Albert Brooks performance. He hadn't been in a movie in years. It's something very different than anything he's ever done before. It's a thing that was scripted for him. There's no improvisation in it whatsoever. He never plays for a laugh. It may be the closest thing to a real performance Albert Brooks has ever given in the movie. And just because of this, the white-hot Ryan Gosling stardom of last year, I mean, he was in certainly a pretty big movie of last summer, the aptly titled Crazy Stupid Love. I think people assumed that he would get some kind of recognition. And he's also in a movie with Oscar favorite George Clooney. They did The Ides of March together. So I think there was some assumption that the movie would get some recognition from the Academy besides the sound editing or best tool belt or whatever nomination they got from the technical side of the Academy.
Not that that's not important to have a very good tool belt when you're making a movie.
There are winners, the tool belt part.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Hi, this is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. If you like this show, you'll probably also like other KCRW programs, such as Good Food, Bookworm, The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell, and Unfictional. You'll find them all in the podcast section of iTunes and on your KCRW smartphone app.
And we're back. I'm Kim Masters, host of The Business, here with Elvis Mitchell, host of The Treatment. And we're talking about the big awards weekend that awaits us. You know, I saw something recently, I cannot remember where, saying that the Academy doesn't care about certain types of films unless they're made by Marty Scorsese, such as a children's film. And we see certainly that that Marty Scorsese is back in a big way with Hugo this year. And it is really outside of his wheelhouse. And it's arguably a children's film. But also, it's kind of like The Artist. It is a Valentine to the movie business and to the early days of the movie business. And, you know, a big argument for film preservation. It's many, many movies in one. And it's Marty Scorsese's first 3D effort.
Right after my father died, I'd come up here a lot. I'd imagine the whole world was one big machine. Machines never come with any extra parts, you know. They always come with the exact amount they need. So I figured if the entire world was one big machine, I couldn't be an extra part. I had to be here for some reason. And that means you have to be here for some reason too.
It's funny because I think it's a movie for kids in Dickens novels. I mean, it's such a kind of a sprawling, I think in its way, demanding movie. There are no simple pleasures to be found in it, certainly because that's the way Martin Scorsese works. But I just kind of feel like, you know, a 2-hour and 20-minute long 3D movie, I don't think the kids who were in it could sit through it. So I don't know if young audiences are going, well, I don't know. Rango or Hugo? Let's see what Martin Scorsese is cooking up for us youth. What's the fun meal like for Hugo?
From the business point of view, the Hugo is going to be a staggering financial loss for the person who financed it, Graham King, who's really one of the great money men, showmen of Hollywood producers at this point.
He really is, unlike a lot of people, one of these guys who goes out and says, listen, these are the filmmakers I want to be in business with. I want to make movies with Johnny Depp. I want to work with Martin Scorsese. And whatever they want to make, these passion projects they want to do, I'll make them with them.
He was involved with Martin Scorsese on The Departed, which, of course, was a big success. And again, one of those films that's like maybe not the kind of film that normally gets the Academy's attention, but with Martin Scorsese attached, oh, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. 3D kids films, remakes of Hong Kong genre movies.
Exactly. So more perhaps in the normal Academy wheelhouse is a movie that it almost seems like it was, you know, invented with the Academy in mind, The Help.
I think it's in the Academy's servants' quarters.
And, you know, I realize, Elvis, for various reasons, this may not be your pick.
Certainly for one big one.
Which is?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess the last Oscar nominee that sort of tackled the same material in the same kind of, is whitewashed, the word I want to use for it, way, would be Mississippi Burning.
I thought you were going to say Driving Miss Daisy.
No. There's a tradition of them.
Oh, okay.
You know, there
I'm
are
sorry.
A number of them.
Okay.
Driving Miss Daisy was a big Broadway hit that I remember people walking out of. You could watch. I had a game I played with friends of mine. You could watch the looks of the black people looking at the white people who walked out of Driving Miss Daisy.
Little surly, glowering look, perhaps.
Yes, and it's amazing that movies like these movies that are big middle brow hits that congratulate white people for not killing black people when they had the chance were movies that nobody wanted to make. It was a big fight to get Driving Miss Daisy made, and as you were able to discover on your show, it was a big passion play to get The Help made.
Yes, we interviewed Catherine Stockett, the author of the bestseller, The Help, and she had optioned her book before it was published to her childhood lifelong friend, Tate Taylor, a guy with no resume worth noting in Hollywood. He was a major negative, in fact, when it came to trying to get the project set up somewhere, but she would not back off on having him involved with the film.
We couldn't get any love out there because of me. We just couldn't. And Michael Barnathan and Chris Columbus would, you know, I think they didn't want me to get my spirits down. I think they were trying to keep theirs alive, too, because
right.
We have this hit book and people just, you know, it's just, you know, it's a female cast. It's period. It's Tate. It's,
I'm sure,
you know,
African-Americans, and, too, had some. I mean, does that have something to do with it as well?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, we wanted Octavia Spencer to be Minnie, and no one knew who she was. And, you know, and I'd written the part of Charlotte Phelan to be Allison Janney. I mean, this was our group. And I think there were so many components that we just didn't want to waver on. It just increasingly became more and more easy to say no.
Catherine, did you feel at any time like saying, so Tate, you know, I know we said we'd do this, but honestly, I want to see the movie of my book, or were you with their all?
Mm-mm.
No, you never
Mm-mm.
wavered.
You can ask anybody. I am a tire kicker. It does take me a long time, but once I make up my mind to do something, God help the person that gets in my way. So no, I was on board, and if it was going to have to be a $1.5 million independent, then so be it.
Wow. I'm sorry. I'm just so touched that story. I wish I liked the movie. and the funny thing about that is, you know, probably the biggest risk of all these movies, the one that is less likely to be a fait accompli than any of these films, and you look at these incredibly sort of well-respected directors here, what's the biggest hit on the list of these films, the Best Picture nominees? It's The Help.
And, you know, I know, Elvis, that you do have issues with the film, and I'm going to be Switzerland because I am not a critic, but surely—
You are people, though.
I am a
people.
Person. But surely the recognition that seems headed, I mean, it's not locked, but for Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer, that's a good thing, right? I mean, those are good performances, and they deserve to be recognized.
And still no silver.
Maybe I can't send you to jail for what you wrote. But I can send you for being a thief.
I know something about you. Don't you forget that. But what you may say is there's a lot of time to write letters in jail. Plenty of time to write the truth about you. And the paper's free.
Nobody would believe what you wrote.
I don't know. I've been told I'm a pretty good writer, already sold a lot of books.
Yeah, those are good performances, too. And with any luck, they'll keep them working. But that's, you're talking about the Oscar bounce for careers. And it's happened so often, especially for actors of color to get nominated. You know, the next thing you know, they're co-starring with Kira Sedgwick on some show about a couple of lady cops on the USA Network. You know, I mean, that doesn't always lead to work for them. You know, black actors get Oscar nominations or win Oscars. And next thing you know, they're like doing a Tyler Perry movie.
The other big box office success, it's not a Best Picture nominee, although it looked like it might be, as Bridesmaids.
And were you surprised that it wasn't? Because I thought for sure it would be a Best Picture nominee.
I was actually not surprised.
Because?
Well, a couple of reasons. I just think the Academy tends to be, think about history. When have they nominated comedies, really? They're horribly snotty to comedies, even though, I mean, to me, I still can't get over that Eddie Murphy wasn't nominated for...
Nutty Professor?
No, Bowfinger. He was great in Bowfinger.
I think the Nutty Professor performance is maybe one of the greatest performances. It's one of the first times he's ever generous in terms of character, but we
either
can talk
one.
About either one. Sure, absolutely.
So, you know, comedy, it's tough. And this one was a raunchy comedy, which probably adds an extra layer of challenge. It did get some love in the beginning, and then it didn't get there.
Well, given that it got the nominations for screenplay and Best Supporting Actress, some part of me always thinks that the way the, if you pardon the expression, the business runs, that you do, besides giving like that sort of sop of Best Original Screenplay, which has gone to nominations to movies as weird as Beverly Hills Cop, which is all improvised.
It's like the Miss Congeniality Award.
Yes. And my favorite Best Original Screenplay nominee would be Crocodile Dundee.
Okay.
So this falls in that tradition. We'll pat it on the head a little bit, but I just thought, given the amount of money it made, given what it did for women in the business, given that in its way it was kind of a social phenomenon as well as a comedy hit, that might accrue to its favor.
It was a breakthrough for women. I mean, a lot of people thought a kind of a raunchy comedy, an R-rated comedy by and about women might be a problem. We had Annie Mumolo and Kristen Wiig on The Business. They wrote the screenplay that's now nominated. They needed the help of Judd Apatow, a really established producer whose word goes far at Universal, to get the project sold like he could do it with the snap of his fingers.
We pitched him the idea, and then, you know, he said, okay, cool. You know, so we were like going home, and then we talked over the night, and then we had another idea. Do you remember? We had another idea.
Yes.
And we were like, oh, we should probably do that other idea. Maybe the other one. Okay, yeah. So we called him and told him, and then he was like, no, oh yeah, no, I already sold the other one. We were like, what? We didn't know anything about sort of how any of that worked or anything. So,
well, he didn't waste much time. I mean,
no, it was like the next morning, I think.
So now you're kind of pregnant with Bridesmaids.
Yes.
It was a long pregnancy.
Yes, it was.
Gestation of Bridesmaids.
Yeah, it was like four and a half years of writing.
So what happens? Yeah. You just, I mean, tell me the process.
Well, for me, I was at SNL, so I was in New York and she was in LA, and we wanted to write it together. We didn't want to really write it over the phone.
Yeah.
So I would fly out to LA and we would meet and like discuss it. And I think I had like a 2-week break and we sat down and wrote it. Yeah, Thanksgiving. Literally Thanksgiving dinner
together.
We spent at
Maggiano's at the Grove
with our computer, and we're like, oh my gosh, what's happening to our lives?
So you're working, and what's happening? I mean, are you writing drafts?
Well, our very first draft we wrote took us 6 days, I think.
Yeah.
We crammed it, and we didn't know how to write a movie. So we're like, we turned it in, we were like, we're done. And he was like, what? You're done?
Yeah. Yeah. And then he called and he said, I'm going to give you notes. For some reason, I was getting the call. So I was at Subway or something. And I was like, oh, I'll just write him on this little napkin. Like, he has notes. And then, like, 25 minutes into it, I was like, I'm scribbling on a napkin that's going to, like, melt him. I got so scared. I'm like, oh, these are a lot of notes. There's a lot of notes. Oh, my gosh. And then realized, you know, that's the beginning of the process that goes on for many years.
Well, it was also quite a collaboration. This sort of came from, you know, as we know, Judd Apatow putting this team together. But I had Paul Feig on my show on The Treatment, and he talked about the movie being really a way for him to reclaim his career as a film director, which it kind of stepped a little far afield with the failure of the movie Unaccompanied Minors. And he looked at it as a way back into the movie business and a way to sort of do something that meant something to him as well.
Oh, I've been in movie jail for about 5 years.
Because?
Because of a little movie called Unaccompanied Minors.
Which actually has its roots in public radio. It comes from This American Life.
Yeah, it was one of Ira Glass's, you know, from his show. I was very happy with the film. There was issues that I had of, you know, things behind the scenes that happened where we had to change script, things I didn't want to change, and blah, blah, blah. Every director in the world can tell you these stories. But I was, you know, I was happy with the outcome, and we would do test screenings of it, and it would test in the high 90s with audiences and kids. So that, you know, you can't do much more than that. But either a movie clicks with an audience or it doesn't. And the if you have a movie that comes out and it doesn't make much money, then you are not that sexy to the town anymore. So it's a bummer. You're kind of always hoping you can get out of it. And thankfully, Judd showed up and pulled me out of movie jail, which was very nice of him.
I mean, had you talked about doing other movies with him before Bridesmaids?
We were always trying to figure out something to do. We've been wanting to work together. We haven't worked together since Freaks, other than I directed one episode of Undeclared. But yeah, we're always talking about it and couldn't quite figure it out, just because we want that perfect thing. We just have a very distinct voice when the two of us work together and needed that project. So it wasn't until this one popped up that was like, yeah, that's it. Because I was really wanting to do something with strong female, you know, characters and actresses. So this felt like the perfect mix.
I'm Elvis Mitchell, the host of The Treatment. I'm sitting with Kim Masters. She's the host of The Business. We just listened to Paul Feig, the director of Bridesmaids, talking about the battle to get that movie made and what the movie meant to him. And I think there's still so many cases of this here. That's still this prevailing narrative. One of the filmmakers I had on my show after I saw his movie at Sundance is J.C. Chandor, who raised the tiny bit of money it took to get Margin Call made. And this is a movie that deserves the Best Original Screenplay nomination that it got. He put together an incredible cast. Many of the actors came to work for 2 or 3 days, like Jeremy Irons or Paul Bettany, who just came in for a couple of days to do work. But there's also Kevin Spacey in the movie. There's Demi Moore in the movie. There's Penn Badgley in the movie. A lot of people really wanted to be a part of this. The one thing, too, that the indie world has going for is that actors will still work for nothing for a great piece of material, and they got just that with Margin Call.
And Mr. Sullivan, what does your model say that means for us here?
Well, that's where it becomes a projection. But,
You're speaking with me, Mr. Sullivan.
Well, sir, if those assets decrease by just 25% and remain on our books, that loss would be greater than the current market capitalization of this entire company.
So, what you're telling me is that the music is about to stop, and we're going to be left holding the biggest bag of odorous excrement ever assembled in the history of capitalism.
And yet on the other side of the coin, a lot of people thought it could be an Oscar contender, and the company simply did not have the money to wage the kind of campaign that might have gotten a nomination for Kevin Spacey or any number of other people.
I think that Paul Bettany performs as one of the best of the year in the film, by the way.
Yeah, so you see that there's a, you know, even when you win, sometimes you can't take yourself to the place where you would think that you would find someone to back you in that play, but in this case it didn't quite happen. Nonetheless, there was a victory.
And well, Chandler talks about how this thing fell into place. He hadn't worked for a long time, basically sort of building a computer almost out of nothing to get this thing written. I think he, in effect, wrote it on a Commodore 64 or something like that. But he wrote it and got the movie out there, and he talks about it with me.
This idea kind of turned into a potential story, and I started to put it together. And then I sat down in about 4 days and wrote the first draft of this script. I hadn't written anything in a long time. I'd sort of gone away from writing for a bit for a bunch of different reasons.
What were those reasons?
I had had, you know, a film crumble, you know, right at the moment, the starting gate. And I was just crushed. I was flat out, you know, creatively and emotionally crushed by the whole experience. And so I was, scared away from the business for a little bit. You know, it was my, you know, my last kind of ditch at the industry. And I also, though, in a neat way.
Did it really feel like that?
I don't mean to make it sort of melodramatic, but I literally at that point, you know, had a 4.5-year-old daughter. There were responsibilities that were starting to weigh on me where I kind of had to go get a job. I actually wrote the thing on a It's about an 8-year-old laptop, and it was such an old machine that you actually couldn't use modern-day email. So it was kind of very symbolic. There was about a week period where I actually couldn't get the script off of this Macintosh. But I finally got the version off of there, and it was 82 pages, and I sent that out into the world, and I said, if I'm any good, I think this is as good, you know, as I've done. And so let's see what happens.
If you're just joining us, I'll tell you what you're listening to. I'm Elvis Mitchell, host of The Treatment. I'm here with Kim Masters. She hosts The Business on KCRW. We're talking about the big award season coming to its spectacular conclusion this weekend.
So should we go to Pariah?
Yeah, let's do that.
There's a film nominated in the Spirit Awards, Elvis, that's in the same kind of category. It's not nominated for a Best Picture, but a special category for new filmmakers, right?
Yeah, they really want to spread the wealth around, and it's one of the things that they do that the Academy should try to do. The Academy should do all these kinds of things like, you know, Best Black and White Film, and I've talked about this with you before. That's the thing I think the Golden Globes has right, having comedy and drama. And what the Spirit Awards does is they've got that category, not only Cassavetti Awards, which is a way to sort of give filmmakers who wouldn't have the resources to get a film out to mainstream audiences, but there's also this Best First Feature, so they can have, in effect, 10 nominees for Best Picture. And Pariah is a movie that Dee Reese, who I had on my show, The Treatment, to talk about the movie, she fought to get made. It's the other side of The Help, and that's a movie primarily with African-American actresses, but it's an autobiographical story, and it's based on real facts as compared to this, you know, out of the pages of The Amazing Spider-Man's wife. Anyway, let's not go back to The Help.
let's
celebrate Pariah, which is a movie that's – she worked it out really well. I mean, she thought about what her strengths were and found actresses and tried to cast them in ways that were counterintuitive, in a way these actresses wouldn't normally be cast. I mean – I think she may have single-handedly given Kim Wayans an acting career, which is no small feat and the kind of bet a studio would never make on an actress like that. But she found other actresses as well for the film, this basically story kind of her own life, and she talked about it with me.
I love these actors and this cast. I mean, yeah, that's my favorite part of the process, just like finding them. And Sabrina Guevara, who plays the teacher, like I had seen her like in some supporting roles, but I just saw her face and, you know, thought like she's the teacher, like I want to see her like do this role. And we saw some tape and she was it. And like I wanted somebody who was believable, and like I didn't want to have, you know, the white savior teacher, you know, who comes down and lifts the children out of their misery. You know, I wanted this to be a woman who really gets Alike on a lot of different levels. And Sabrina was that, and just like honest, candid, you get it, you know. And with Kim Wayans, who plays the mom, you know, I didn't want a typical angry black mom. I wanted to show that black femininity is not monolithic. You know, these are different women who live to different things and speak differently. And Kim really brought this vulnerability and the sensitivity to it. You had to empathize with her and understand, you know, what she was afraid of in order to really understand her character.
I'm Elvis Mitchell, host of The Treatment. I'm sitting here with Kim Masters, host of The Business. We'll be back to disagree more about the Oscar nominees and Spirit nominees. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment. KCRW is a nonprofit public radio station. We thrive on the support of listeners like you. Make a donation at kcrw.com/join.
We're back. I'm Elvis Mitchell, host of The Treatment, here with Kim Masters, host of The Business. We're talking about the awards that you're going to be watching this weekend, the Spirit Awards and the Oscars. Another woman director I had on my show, Jennifer Yeo Nelson, director of Kung Fu Panda 2 in 3D, the bookend to Hugo and the 3D nominee that made some money this year. She started off in basically sort of one of the below-the-line people on the first Kung Fu Panda and some other movies, but it was a chance to do, for her, get her passions into a big studio film. Her love of sort of cheesy action genre films. She grew up loving people not like Jean-Claude Van Damme, Jean-Claude Van Damme himself. And wanted to try to find a way to...
I wonder if she's gotten over that yet, but go on.
Now she watches reality television, she hasn't. But it's a really sweet movie, and she talks about a way of finding her own path to invest herself in a big studio 3D film.
I grew up watching a lot of great action movies. I mean, that's the thing that I wanted to do the most as a kid. I wanted to do action movies.
No kidding. What did you want to do? Which movies did you love?
Well, I was like watching all the Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. I watched Cyborg in the theater twice. I dragged my sister to it twice, and she was like, oh, no, I don't want to see that again. But, you know, she wasn't a fan of action movies. But I just loved it. And I watched every one of those 80s movies that ended with the ors, like the Eliminators or the Terminator, or, you know, every
the Exterminators,
copycat.
All those movies. Yeah, the posters were better than the movie.
Yeah, they were all pretty, you know. But they were beautiful. I enjoyed it because they had a lot of heart. But that doesn't go to the core of what the emotional thing is, because those were really fun as a kid. But as I grew up, I was really gravitating to anime. And a lot of the action in anime is very emotionally driven. And a lot of great films that I loved were very emotionally driven. One of my favorite movies is Blade Runner, and it's a very emotionally driven action film. So the things that I liked about it, the things that I can grab onto when I'm thinking of a character or thinking of a story, I have to get that hook of what is the moment that's going to hit you in the chest really hard, where everything becomes clear and you understand that what makes that character tick.
So it may not seem like the most natural pairing to talk about this next film, Beginners, in the same breath with Kung Fu Panda 2. But, you know, the films we've just been talking about, Pariah, Kung Fu Panda 2, and this film, Beginners, these are all movies in which the directors have brought something very personal about their lives into the film.
I think you're right, because there's something kind of unapologetic about these people exposing parts of their lives and the way sexuality affected their family, certainly in the case of Pariah and Beginners. And these are movies that if they had been made 15 years ago, even there would be a real sort of painful, melodramatic cast to them. They'd be like something done in some Stygian depth somewhere. The pain of recognizing the love that dared not speak its name. But there's a real kind of lovely, lyrical, bouncy quality in the Christopher Plummer performance. I mean, it's in the way it's like he's coming out as an entertainer after all these years, you know?
An elderly man loses his wife of many years and finally comes out of the closet, gets to be himself, and he has an adult son, in this case played by...
Ewan McGregor.
Ewan McGregor.
Oliver?
Yeah?
I'm not sorry I woke you.
I went to Akbar tonight.
You did?
Yeah, oh, they had some wonderfully loud
music. What kind of music's that?
Probably house music.
Yeah. House music. Okay. House music.
There's just this lovely, as you say, I mean, it's not like it's such easy sailing, but there is this triumph of love quality to the film in which, based on director Mike Mills's own life, and Mike Mills was a guest on your show, and in the story, the character played by Christopher Plummer in what will probably be recognized on Sunday as a winning award, gets to just finally be himself.
My parents were born in 1924, 1925. Their first date was in 1939. They went and saw Gone with the Wind. They had me when they were 40. In 1966. So my parents were like kind of wildly different and old than all my friends' parents, almost Victorian feeling, you know. So anyways, after they were married for 44 years, my mom passed away. And 6 months later, my real dad came out of the closet. And as Christopher says in the movie, he didn't want to be just theoretically gay. He wanted to do something about it, a.k.a. he was super horny and wanted to have sex. And what really happened, and how this relates to Beginners more than just being a portrait of my dad, is when he came out, he was just so different. Like, and my dad at 75 all of a sudden became very 16, you know, and I was like 33 when he came out. So we had just so much more alive, intense conversations and arguments, and he would argue with me about my choices. And so my gay dad really taught me a lot, or got a lot more engaged in my heterosexual relationships than my straight dad ever did. And then he died, and my dad's passing, or my dad when he was sick, he was so hungry and happy and going for it, you know? And in my portrait of him, I wanted to have that piece of him in the film.
That was Mike Mills, the writer-director of Beginners, who's on my show, The Treatment, for the second time. And he's just so in love with letting actors find their own way. He builds these things that are, they really aren't star pieces. They're ensemble pieces. And you get that sense of the joy the actor is playing together. I mean, and it does shift tones. There is some dramatic stuff, because as the father is coming out of his shell, the son has to also deal with the loss of his mother and where his own life is going to go. And that's treated for a kind of a deadpan melodrama, but it's not sort of this thing where you bite into it and it bleeds in Splenda at all. It has its own reality, and Mike just has so much control as a director. He has the same finesse that Christopher Plummer has as a performer in the film.
So, Elvis, these are nominees that will all have their moments on the red carpet. Others will not be so lucky. Anyone you want to pick out, a movie or a performance that you – we talked a little bit about Albert Brooks. Is there a movie or performance that you really feel was overlooked this year?
Gosh, there are always so many for me. Probably a foreign film that I loved as much as I loved any film in the last 10 years, a film made by a Finnish filmmaker named Aki Kaurismäki called Le Havre. It's just kind of a de facto sequel to a movie he made 20 years ago that nobody saw as well either, his version of La Vie de Bohème. And he picks it up 20 years later, brings race into the equation. It's set in France, a small harbor in northern France. And it's a wonderful little film. And I wish it had just gotten some kind of recognition in the foreign film category. It really is one of my favorite films of the decade.
Yeah, for me, I look at it through more of the business lens. But I have to say, for maybe this year, there isn't that one film that just feels like it is the winner and it should win and it deserves to win. But
there's not one of those for you here in this grouping?
No. I mean, I could find some. Well, my point is, I do feel like in past years when there have only been 5 nominees, and this year there are 9, I guess, since they expanded and they keep jiggling the rules. But for the Oscars, that is. But in past years, I've sort of gotten to maybe 3 movies that I think could really even get nominated. And then I used to think, well, how are they going to fill out the 5? And this year, while maybe none of them is that luminous, perfect movie, I feel like you don't have to be embarrassed about this group of nominees. We'll give you the possible exception of The Help, which you, dislike a lot, I know.
Have you seen War Horse?
and I haven't seen War Horse, so but there's a group of movies here where there's something to like about them, no?
Yeah, I think that's kind of, they feel like these movies that, it's like a great group of movies that are completely entertaining in very mainstream ways. I mean, there's nothing that's quite as square as classic winners of the past, like, you know, The King's Speech, which, you know, the joke I made about it, is the best film in 1939. There's not one of those films in this group that I know feels that way, feels like it's the sure thing. But I guess what feels interesting to me about this year's Oscar field, and even the Spirits feel too, is that there's so much stuff in play. I mean, I don't know that The Artist has a lock on it, that Descendants has a chance, I think.
I would say The Help has a chance.
Yeah, you know what? That's probably true too. And even though maybe there's not as much excitement about all the movies, I think there is excitement about the fact that these races are kind of wide open, that I don't think at this point anybody can even safely say who's going to win Best Actor. It could be Jean Desjardins or it could be George Clooney.
Absolutely, or even Brad Pitt, and coming out of left field, if those two happen to split some votes, you know, even in Best Actress, Meryl Streep or Viola Davis could be either way.
I don't think you can. Anybody should write Meryl Streep off. You do that, you're peril at this point.
You're peril. So we do have some horse races. Having said that, I guess looking finally through the lens of the business again, this is a huge televised event. The Academy has had its challenges with the show, and without an Avatar or a Titanic, both of which happen to be made by the same filmmaker, regardless of the merits of the film, which I will invite you to laugh at if you want to.
Well, I would never do that to your face. No.
Regardless, when you're looking at, you know, billion-dollar grosses for these movies, those translate into huge ratings. And this year we have Billy Crystal back, you know, Brett Ratner was going to be the producer. Eddie Murphy was going to host. They both dropped out. We have Billy Crystal.
A friend of mine said they should do a documentary and call it The Oscars, and it almost wasn't.
Right. So it's going to be interesting to see whether these guys, and I don't mean to be at all ageist. I'm hardly in a position to be ageist, but I will say this is an old guard show, and they've been trying to freshen it up for years. Will it not be interesting to see how much America wants to tune in and watch the Oscars on Sunday?
I don't know. It's funny because you look at this, too. In this list, the biggest hit Woody Allen has ever had is in this, which is, you know, like saying it made almost as much money as Hugo.
Right.
But it didn't cost as much money as
right.
Hugo. And it's an enormous thing for Woody. I mean, apparently he's really feeling his oats now between the Woody Allen documentary on American Masters last year and this film. He's feeling like, you know, he's got a new lease on life at the age of 74, and he's got a lot of movies ahead of him now. But I don't think there's anything wrong with the Oscars embracing the fact that it's square. Award shows are square. And when you try to do something that makes it not square, you get James Franco selling out Anne Hathaway 2 weeks after the broadcast. So it's probably better to have somebody like Billy Crystal, who got the biggest response last year when he showed up to a presenting award.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that plays. I'll tell you one sure thing.
What's that?
Uggie the dog from The Artist, will be on that stage on Sunday night. We do not live in a world where that's not
happening.
Even
if he has to take a whiz on the Tree of Life, he'll be on the stage then?
I think that he will be there. Meanwhile, at the Spirit Awards, Seth Rogen, which to me, frankly, I'm sort of thinking, why didn't they get him to host the Oscars?
I was going to say, he's as much mainstream, although it helps that he had a movie that he produced and starred in this year, 50-50, that's a Spirit Awards nominee. But that's the fun thing about the Spirit Awards is you get a host who can basically sort of let the air out of the balloon and make a show of letting the air out of the balloon and letting out all the pomposity. There have been a number of hosts who've done that and who have feet in both worlds, from John Waters to Sarah Silverman to now to Seth Rogen, people who basically their awareness of the business is part of who they are. And there's a level of irony there that you'd never get somebody in the Oscars to do. And that's the kind of the sad thing about it. Maybe, though, things will change in the future. They'll have to get somebody in. I'm sure that was a hope in having Eddie Murphy do it.
Well, and, you know, the reality is that because the Academy Awards is such a huge global televised event, people don't want to do it. They don't see an upside. People, you know, have gone out there and tried and are sort of mocked and ridiculed. It's almost, I can't remember when someone has come out of a show lately and people have said, that was awesome.
As you mentioned, I think about an Oscar show that I happen to like. I may be one of the few that did. But when Chris Rock hosted the show, he did this produced piece when he went to the Magic Johnson theaters and nobody there had heard of a single Oscar nominee.
And I remember that. It's
and
funny.
There was not, when they cut back to the theater, there was not a single laugh there in that room. You see people, how they could feel how unmoored they were to the popular culture that pays for the movies. And you would have thought that was somehow sent a signal to the Academy. But I feel like the Academy is finally, it's ceded that ground. There was that period where mainstream movies got nominated for Oscars. And as you say, it's also because the studios don't make those movies anymore. But it doesn't happen. I mean, look at, for the most part, these movies are all made or made by people who have made an independent film.
Well, that is all the Oscar special we have time for. I'm Kim Masters with Elvis Mitchell, and this has been KCRW's look at the Oscars and the Spirit Awards. Fun, Elvis, right?
I'm still laughing. Thanks, Kim.
This show is produced by Darby Maloney and Jenny Radlett, with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Mario Diaz. And special thanks to Taryn Olson. To hear the clips we played and to see a hilarious Funny or Die video of the Artist star Jean Dujardin as a bad guy in a big action movie, go to kcrw.com/awardspecial, where you can stream and download this program. Thanks for listening.